So good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out this evening. Thank you, virtual audience, for joining us. It's a rare pleasure to have Claire McIntosh back with us. And I remember her first U.S. book tour when she came to see us. Do you remember that?
January 2017.
You do remember that.
I was quite wide-eyed and a bit scared.
And you were on your way, if I remember, to what? ALA, the library? You were on your way to something.
Yeah, I don't remember. I was doing a big tour. I was in a lot of places that I'd never been to before. I hadn't really done much traveling on my own before, and it just everything was quite scary. And I was only in Scottsdale then for about 19 hours, I think.
So you hardly really got to see Scottsdale.
No, whereas this time, I've been here for two nights already. I'm practically applying for my green card. I love it.
She got to go to the Desert Botanical Garden, and right at the moment...
It was amazing. And then I was forced to buy a pair of new boots. Because you can't actually come to Arizona and not buy a pair of cowboy boots, can you?
Ideal. To really complete the whole thing, you needed to hit a turquoise shop. But next time.
maybe tomorrow morning.
Right.
I almost bought a hat. You're actually very lucky that I didn't turn up in a full Western hat.
So Claire lives in one of my very favorite places called Wales, which is a really beautiful, smaller part of the UK. And I've been lucky enough to travel there many times. And you get to it's the distances seem so big. You can put the whole British Isle in Arizona, okay? So you have to start with that. But having said that, traveling in England can take you longer than if you're just driving to Tucson because the roads are small and the traffic is terrific. And so people don't really move around the UK quite as freely as they do around
people
Arizona.
People complain a lot. I was saying to Barbara as we walked here from dinner that people in the UK complain if they've got to travel 20 minutes to an event. And I've had people online saying, oh, I'm going to be in LA. It's going to take me 4 hours to drive. So it's great. I'm really looking forward to it. There's no way anyone would do that in the UK.
Well, but it's easier to drive a long distance here. I've driven a lot in England, and I know then it's more challenging. But anyway, if you have a chance to go to Wales, which is truly beautiful, it has mountains, it has lakes, it has seacoast, it has mines, it has a cool little train, sort of like the Verde Canyon Railroad, and it has an incredible garden called Bodnant, which Claire and I were talking about at dinner. It's just extraordinary. And it has a whole bunch of cool castles because for a long time, Wales and England had, and maybe there still is some tension there. Is there still some tension there?
I'm very conscious that this is being streamed, and so I don't want to get myself into trouble. There is a little bit of tension.
Right. And part of it is that that Wales is returning or at least allowing or encouraging its citizens to go back to Welsh, which is a wonderful language, in the same way that you see the Gaelic in Scotland, depending on how far north you go. So, you know, I'm glad we had a sort of similar thing here with Native Americans who were forced into local schools and had to give up their languages and other things. And now I think it's reversing.
Right. And so the English did some really terrible things to the Welsh over the years. And one of them was to try and stop them using their own language. And this is relevant to a book event because this is precisely where A Game of Lies and the first book in the series, The Last Party, set. And so England basically tried to colonize Wales and stop people from speaking their own language. So it's understandable, I think, that there's some tension between the two countries.
But it's really fun to go. I'm probably the only person here old enough to remember Prince Charles when forced into his investiture as Prince of Wales in Caernarfon Castle, which was God knows how long. It must have been 50 years ago or something like that, but I can still remember that. But there's wonderful things to do if you go there. And I was telling Claire that one day I went to visit a castle at Conwy, and ended up sitting on the city walls talking to the city mason, who said that the problem with being the city mason is that nobody wanted to be an apprentice, wanted to succeed him. So we had a long conversation about, you know, the younger generation and what
people... Did he offer you the job?
No, I was too old and female besides, but I don't know that that would have mattered, to be fair. But, you know, it's just that, I mean, think about it, trying to maintain the fabric of an ancient castle in terms of the stones and the city walls and all does require people who actually know how to do that. And that was really his concern, was that, you know, it would fall into disrepair without him. So it's a very old country, very old part, but beautiful. So you moved to Wales from the Cotswolds, and did that inspire you to write your series that we are here to discuss?
It did. Yeah, we moved there in 2016. And in fact, when I was on tour here, we were just about to close on a house. So we'd already moved. We were renting in Wales. Because I remember talking to someone in this store about how my mother hated that I was so far away. I'm 3 hours from my mother. But it was like I was emigrating. Mm-hmm. And then in, when was it? January. When was lockdown? 2020? Mm-hmm. So January 2020, I was standing on the edge of the lake. There's a very big lake in the town where I live now. And I swim there all year round. I love it. I love the cold water. And on one of the things I do is organize the New Year's Day swim. So the polar dip, I think you call them. And we were all standing there waiting to go in, waiting for 10 o'clock for the klaxon. And it's very gorgeous. The water was flat. It was like a mirror. You could see the mountains reflected in the water. And the mist was doing that thing where it sort of sits on the surface of the water. And everyone around me was saying, oh, it's so beautiful. It's so lovely. Aren't we lucky? And I was thinking, what if a body floats through the water? Because that's what crime writers are like, right? And crime readers. We're always thinking, you know, you take us for a country walk and we're not thinking how lovely the color of the leaves are. We're wondering how long it takes for a body to decompose in this particular circumstance. So that was the start of me thinking, oh, I would like to set a story here. And because we then went straight into the pandemic and into lockdown, and borders became important in a way that they hadn't been before. So England and Wales, as you've just brilliantly described, two very different countries, but with a soft border. You know, you can drive in between the two, no one really notices. But we have different governments, we have different health authorities, and so we had different laws in the pandemic. And suddenly this border became really important. And what I wanted to do was to set a crime on that border. So I wanted to have a lake where the border ran right through the middle of the lake, and any crimes that occurred would have to be jointly investigated by England and Wales. So that's what happens in The Last Party, and it's consequently what happens in A Game of Lies, which is the second in the series.
Right. So the English side of it, the closest, if I remember right, is at Chester?
Yeah, it's the closest big, yeah, big
closest
town.
Closest big town and so forth. So what you've created then is a necessity for your Welsh policewoman to cooperate with somebody on the English side.
Exactly. And I've made that somebody on the English side a really hot male detective. Because I think that if you're going to write about someone for a year and then go on tour promoting them, you should make them hot.
If you'd anticipated romanticity, you could have had a dragon.
It is lacking in sexy dragons.
Because the Welsh, actually, the dragon is a key thing in Wales. So
that's true. There's a huge opportunity here for a Welsh sexy dragon.
Right. Damn They're it. Right there on the flags and so forth. So it would have been ideal. Well, you know, none of us can see that far ahead, but it would have been. And you still have a chance. You know, still write a Welsh romanticy with a dragon.
It's coming in book three. Yeah.
I love the idea. So what you've done is you've created this very prickly female policewoman who doesn't really like, she doesn't play well with others in the police department. And she has difficult relationships with her family. So conflict is that thing that is so important in crime novels, right? It's not just about the murder.
No, it's not. It's all about the conflict. Conflict between what the main character wants versus whatever it is that's getting in their way.
Right.
Conflict between relationships. Fionn is interesting. I mean, I really love Fionn. Fionn is my Welsh detective. Fionn, Detective Constable Fionn Morgan. And I love her partly because she's really me.
Oh, come on. You weren't really that difficult, were you?
I think I was challenging in the police. Okay. So I was a police officer for 12 years. I was just a bit... Nowadays, I'm a bit more chilled out and I don't pick fights unless I really have to, whereas I think I was a bit prickly when I was younger. So when I joined the police, this is a very British thing that I'm going to have to try and explain to you, but in the olden days, female police officers in Britain were called WPC, Women Police Constable. Okay, so the man would be PC Smith and the woman would be WPC Smith. I can see your face and I agree with you. And then round about kind of mid to late 90s, which was when I joined, they abolished the W. So we were all just PCs, right? All just police constable, just like you might all be doctor or reverend or whatever. But people were still using W, and so I would be called WPC. And no matter how many times I said, we don't use that term anymore, we're all police constables, we're all paid the same, we do the same job, could you please call me PC? People would still call me WPC. And so eventually, I just stopped hearing it. That was it. And so if someone called me by WPC, I would just completely ignore them, because that wasn't my name. And I feel like that's the sort of thing that Fionn would do. But now, looking back, I think, God, that must have been really annoying. But, you know, I felt really strongly about it. And Fionn feels really passionately about things. She's a very good police officer. From a kind of intuitive point of view, she is appalling at teamwork. She really, I mean, saying she doesn't play well with others is an understatement. I would hate to work with her.
Yeah, I think she'd be very difficult. And I do admire the patience that you have given to her superior, who, you know, keeps putting up with her, even though, you know, in truth.
I mean, she should be sacked, shouldn't she?
Yeah, exactly.
But I think he knows that this is a series. And so...
Right.
If he sacks her, that, you know, it causes me a big problem.
Right.
But she suffers from that that issue you can have when you work and live in the same place. So I did this for a while. I was we don't have sheriffs in the UK, but I was like the town sheriff. I worked in a small town. I was responsible for the policing of that small town, and I also lived there. And that's a really can be quite an uncomfortable situation, because you're socializing, you know, you go to the pub and you see people that maybe you have arrested or you might need to arrest. People would knock on our door because they'd found some lost property and the police station was shut, so they'd brought it to me. And I think it's similar for teachers. So teachers who live and work in the same place can find that slight conflict when they see little Johnny out, you know, on the town when he should be doing his revision. So Fionn has that. She has been brought up in a very small, close-knit community, Welsh-speaking community. And now if a crime happens in her town, the suspects are potentially her friends, her neighbours, her family.
And in the case of in your first book, there's an English element because there's a resort along the lake. And so that forces her to have to work with the English on the other side of the lake.
The hot detective, Leo.
Right, yes. And, you know, yeah. Right, it was the only, minus dragons, it was your best bet, you know, for bringing him in there. And Fionn has not had, you know, successful personal relationships. And so in this book, part of the interesting part of this book, I think, is whether she is going to overcome her reluctance to make herself vulnerable to somebody or not. So we won't tell you if it works out, but that's
We won't, except that in A Game of Lies, in the second book, she fucks it up. And so we then have to read the book to work out, you know, what happens between them and how much of a mess has she made of things.
That's true. And there's a dog. Let's not forget the dog, because the dog is intrusive in the very first scene. The dog is not only undisciplined, but has digestive issues, which make him very unwelcome in the police station.
He's my sexy dragon. He's equivalent.
He's not very sexy. No, he's not. But you're right. He is kind of, right. So you know, Fionn is kind of a package, you know, Fionn and the dog.
Oh, which
makes
it a nightmare. I mean, you know, what this hot detective Leo is doing with Fionn and her flatulent dog, I don't really know, but he is besotted with her.
Well,
she does have a lot of redeeming qualities. She's very funny.
Yeah.
She's a very funny woman, and she's very loyal and very loving, and sharp and quick. I like her a lot.
I like her too. And so we have some hope that eventually the dog will be disciplined to the point where he can be functional.
Do you know what? I'm regretting
the dog. I certainly hope that's going to be in book three.
Well, so I'm regretting the dog mainly because, in A Game of Lies, Dave actually ends up sort of playing quite a pivotal role in things.
He does.
I hadn't planned that. I just gave her a dog at the start of the book. I just thought this will be funny. She's inherited this rescue dog. It was actually a bet between her and her ex-husband. She takes on the dog. The ex-husband says, you know, a tenor says, you're not going to be able to cope with this. And so now, of course, she's got to, because she's not going to lose face in front of the ex. And so it was just a sort of a funny thing. And then Dave, the dog, ended up being quite pivotal. And so now he stays because he's a very important part.
Right. You can't have a hero dog.
Well, no,
I can't
just send him back to the pound. So in book three, which is in a completely sort of different environment, it's actually much more in England. It's all surrounding luxury houses and property porn. I've now got this bloody dog, and every time I write a scene I think, well, who's looking after the dog now? Like, you know, she's out of the house for 8 hours a day. Who's gonna let the dog out? So I'm slightly regretting him.
Well, no, I like Dave. I thought that he did wonders for this. Now, you may, if you know historical mystery at all, if you ever read has anybody here read Ellis Peters, for example? Not one of you? Seriously? You have never read Ellis Peters, A Morbid Taste for Bones? Oh, dear. Okay.
I haven't either.
But anyway, there's a whole sort of border country in England that wanders down from Shrewsbury, and it moves south and so forth through Ludlow and other places. And it's called the Marcher Country, in part because they march back and forth, right, trying to settle things out. Historical mystery has some wonderful books that are set between England and Wales, on one side of the border or the other. And Phil Rickman, another British author who you probably don't know because he's not published in the U.S., has written some amazing books that are set in that kind of marcher country. And there's almost a mystical quality to it, you know, about that border and people moving back and forth over it. I mean, it's it's almost like, you know, things that happened 1,000 years ago happened last week.
I find borders really interesting, and not just geographical borders, but state or county borders, borders between the haves and the have-nots, people who speak one language, who speak another, people from one class and another class, all those sort of divisions I think are very interesting, particularly when you have people who cross over lines or who have a foot in each camp. I hear a lot of crime writers talking about the gray area, so they're not talking just about black and white, they're talking about that kind of slightly murky area in the middle of right and wrong, and that's sort of how I feel about borders, that things that happen on the border of something are really rich territory for a writer.
Absolutely true, especially crime writers. And the Welsh are really more akin to the people in Brittany There's a big musical strain involved. And so if you've read any of Jean-Luc Bandelec's wonderful mysteries that start with the death in Brittany, hilariously, he's actually German who vacations in Brittany. But anyway, that's another whole story. But they're wonderful. And they've been on television, which, not that I told you, that explains why it's a German TV thing of a French series. But that happens. But anyway, there's the Celtic strain is very different than the Anglo-Saxon strain. And so the Welsh tend to be, they're Celtic. And there are people in Cornwall who are Celtic, and then across the way in Brittany. So we're sort of doing like Tristan and Isolde. But there are music festivals and so forth, because the music unites those people. And so in Brittany, you can have wonderful music festivals with people who come from Wales. You know, they're playing harps. They're singing. I mean, there's some wonderful musicians that come from Wales.
Yeah, and I think there's a real camaraderie between marginalized communities, and there always has been. And so they find connections like that.
Right. So in this book, you have created, I mean, and it's interesting because there's another author named Heather Gutenhoff, who you probably haven't run across. And both of them, there are situations that present themselves. And in both this book and Heather's book, it's a reality TV show. And if you bring a bunch of people together and you're going to put them into reality TV, how much of their lives will that expose? How much will the competition bring out the best and the worst of them, and how many bad things can happen? And I do think Claire has in this book one of the truly great escape scenes. I mean, I thought your escape scene was genius.
Thanks. I love an escape scene.
It was really
love
good.
A locked room. Love an escape.
Right.
I find reality TV really fascinating.
I think it's horrific, but
it is horrific. But it's also fascinating. So there's obviously been something in the water with writers recently, because Ruth Ware's summer book this year is also a reality TV
show. She's going to be here on May 22nd.
Right.
So I have another reality TV show.
You've got another reality. I've just read her book, The Perfect Couple. It's superb. What I find fascinating about reality TV is the manipulation. So not just the manipulation of the contestants, which I think we all sort of accept happens, but the manipulation of the viewer, that what we're watching has been predetermined, that these normal people have been cast in particular roles as the villain, the hot one, the old one, the young one, you know, and they've been edited in a way that gives us what the producer wants us to think. And so all the, you know, the voting, it's all irrelevant because they are manipulating what we see.
Well, it's scripted. I mean, you know, reality TV is an oxymoron, because in fact it isn't reality TV at all.
They're
actually scripted.
And I came across a website that exposes the continuity errors in Married at First Sight. If you've not had the pleasure, you actually just don't have the pleasure of watching it. But this website highlights all these continuity errors, and what it shows is where scenes have been filmed again. And so you'll have an argument that is supposedly spontaneous, except that halfway through someone, you know, changes a shirt or does their hair differently, and you realize that that's been a scripted argument that they've come back to and reshot. It's appalling. And I thought it would be fun to play with that and to look at how Fionn, as an investigator, could assess whether someone was telling the truth or a lie if she were watching them in a TV show, but also investigating them in real life. And also, I thought it would be quite fun to have a kind of an impossible murder on the set of a TV show and see how you might try and pull that off without being caught.
Well, to do that, you need to isolate them. So also you need to give them a high stake. I mean, you know, if it's a low stakes thing, people are probably not going to be, killing each other. But if you make the prize or the stakes high enough, you can increase that. But I thought what I really loved about your book was the place that you have this TV show filming, you know, high on a mountain, so to speak, in
I put them on the mountain. Well, in the last party, we were in the lake. And so for a game of lies, we've gone up into the mountains and we've got this TV show being filmed. It's called Exposure. And there are seven contestants on it. And the seven contestants thought they were auditioning for a kind of survival style show. So they thought they were going into the mountains. They would be catching fish, making shelters, that kind of thing. As the cameras start rolling, the presenter tells them that actually that's not the show they're on. The show they're on is still called Exposure, but it's not about survival, it's about secrets. Each of them has a secret, and to stay in the game, they need to protect their secret and expose someone else's. So suddenly, the stakes are raised. They all know that their particular secret will ruin their life, and so there's a lot riding on them staying in the game.
Right. And you also realize that the invitations were not based on merit or date or anything else, but rather the people that the invitations to the participants were based upon research into what secrets they might have.
Dark secrets. And right. when I talked to my editor about this idea, because I was really excited about it, and she said, well, I really like this, but it's a bit dark, isn't it? You know, this reality TV show, would it really happen? And so I went and had a look at some of the genuine reality TV shows that have happened, okay? And we know about things like Married at First Sight or The Bachelor. Some of the other shows that I found are truly horrific. So one of them, these are all American, by the way. I'm saying nothing. One of them was called Who's the Daddy? And it involved an adult woman who had been, who had never known her father. Her father had been a sperm donor, and 12 male contestants, one of whom was her biological dad. And she had to put them through a series of tests and interviews and then pick which one she thought her dad was. I mean, it's hideous. It's an awful, awful thing. There was that one. There was another one where they said that they were auditioning people for the most talented singer, and they put people through to the next round and the next round and the next round. But the twist was that actually they were picking the worst person in each round to put through. And so when this poor unfortunate thought that they had won this nationwide singing competition, you are the best singer in the entire country, they were then informed that actually you're the worst and you're on national TV. I mean, it's so cruel. So frankly, I think my concept isn't nearly as bad as either of those.
No, I don't disagree with you. But I thought that to make your story work, you did need to put them not in a studio in, like, you know, downtown of Los Angeles or somewhere, but you need to isolate them up on the mountain. And that means that the villagers, who have to be like the supply, you know, chain and all the rest of it, the villagers get involved in it as well. So it isn't, it's got a broader reach than it might have otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, camping always puts people under stress, doesn't it? I always feel very stressed when I'm camping. So I figured seven contestants in a tent up a mountain, that was already quite a stressful situation.
It is, so kind of wilderness. But anyway, it's a very interesting, I think it's very well done. And I think the escape scene is terrific. And never forget Dave, the dog, who's essential to how this works out. And then you have to wonder how the relationships are going to mature. So there is going to be at least one more book in this series where you'll be able to pull threads through, right?
I have just delivered the second draft to my UK editor. So that'll be out next year.
So I also thought that we might talk about a book that Claire has written that you might not have thought of. And it's called I Promise It Won't Always Hurt Like This. And this is a memoir. So are you going to be okay talking about it?
Yeah, of course.
All right. So it's your story. So all yours.
So I'd never planned to write a memoir, not least because I always assume memoirs were, well, I put memoirs next to autobiographies, and I assume autobiographies are written by hugely famous people with incredible stories to tell. But I think what's interesting about memoir is that it's often about a small section of someone's life that is particularly significant or profound, and which speaks to other people who have been through that. And that's the case with my memoir, which is about grief. It's about how I've navigated the 18 years since my son died. So he died when he was 5 weeks old from meningitis. And I honestly thought that I would die too. That the grief that I felt was so all-consuming. It was like being hurled from the top of a skyscraper and slamming into the pavement. And for a very long time, it was me. It was everything that I breathed and slept and thought. And while I was in the very early days, maybe 2 months after Alex died, a woman came to my door that I'd never met before. And she had been sent by a mutual friend. And she brought some daffodils from her garden. And she introduced herself and she said that she had had a child who had died herself many years previously. And she'd wanted to come and see me today to promise me that it wouldn't always hurt the way it was hurting for me right then. And I invited her in and we talked, and I have very sort of hazy memories of it because grief does funny things to your memory. But I remember listening to this promise and thinking, okay, you can promise that, but it's not true. It's not going to be true. I will never be okay. It will never stop hurting. I will never be in a position to walk round to a stranger's house and give them some daffodils. And in fact, I thought, and this is a horrible, uncharitable thought, I thought, you can't possibly have loved your child the way I love mine. Because if you had, you wouldn't be standing. You would be broken like I'm broken. And then the thing about grief is that it's a little bit like going on a really long journey. Either, you know, say you're on a train or someone's driving you and you are reading a book or you're engrossed in a conversation, and after a few hours or whatever time, you look up and you look out of the window and you realize that the landscape is totally different now to the way it was at the beginning, and you don't know at what point it changed, and you didn't notice it changing, but it's totally different. You know, where there were skyscrapers, where there were lots of houses and businesses, now there are fields or vice versa. It is different. And that was my grief, that I suddenly looked up after however many years and realized that it didn't hurt the way that it had hurt back then. And because I'm a writer, that's what I do. That's how I make sense of things. And so that's why I wanted to write the memoir, partly to explore the way I'd navigated grief and to find a way of hopefully helping other people navigate it, and to give them something that they could give to a friend if they didn't know what to say, but also to kind of pay it forward a bit for that woman who had done a really generous, incredible thing.
Your version of daffodils, in other words. Yeah. I often think of Emily Dickinson, grief is that thing with wings. We lost our granddaughter to COVID a year ago last October, and I still think about her every day. And I think the hard part when it's somebody so young is that you mourn all the years they didn't get to live. You know, your baby was 5 weeks old, you know, my granddaughter was 27. But, you know, it's the life that they missed. It's different than losing your my mother was 95 or 96 when she died, I think. 91. Anyway, it was a very different feeling.
Yeah, it is. And grief is so multifaceted, isn't it? I've got a friend at the moment whose partner has terminal cancer, and what she's doing is she has this sort of anticipatory grief.
She's grieving now.
Yeah, which, you know, a lot of us have to deal with.
Right, which means that it's more awful now, but will be less awful. And in fact, when somebody is terribly ill for a long time, it's almost a relief or a blessing for them when they die, which
happened
with my sister, as I told you. And, you know, but for a baby, you know, because none of that is really true. So
no, it's hard. You know, it's hard. You can't be relieved. You can't
exactly.
be. You don't have those happy memories. That you know, there were no happy memories.
Right.
There was a traumatic, horrific early delivery of my twins, and then there was 5 weeks in intensive care, the last three of which were fighting for his life. And so you can't have a service where you think about those happy memories, those holidays, those birthdays. You don't have any of that. All you can do is actually just accept what's happening and take every day as it comes.
Yeah. I think about Emily Dickinson. Grief is that thing with wings. And if you're lucky, it does develop wings. You know, which
I think what I've, for me, I've moved from a point where grief consumed me to a point where grief is just a small part of me. And it will always be a part of me, and it should always be a part of me, because, you know, if we don't grieve for someone unless we loved them. And so it's actually a wonderful thing. And it's something that, you know, we don't talk about very much. We don't talk about nearly enough.
Right. Well, immortality, you know, only arises from people who can remember you, you know, and basically when everybody who knew you dies, you know, that's it, except for, you know, historical figures or something. But for most people, you know, it's the memories of the people that knew and loved them. And at some point, you know, that's
it. And I used to, when I used to sort of get, we talk about waves of grief, don't we? And when I used to get these waves and I would think about my son, they would floor me and I would be horribly, horribly upset. And now I see it more, it's a reminder. If I get a wave of grief, it's a reminder of the love that I have for my son. The same as if I think about my father. Sometimes my dad died 3 years after my son died, and I still get that feeling that I'm going to call him. You know, something happens and I think, oh, I'm going to tell daddy that. Oh, I can't. But I think that's a rather lovely thing to have those reminders that they're still the person that pops into your head. What a lovely tribute. What a lovely legacy that they've left us with. I found it really interesting. So I've been touring in the UK with this book, with I Promise. And so I've been having a lot of conversations about grief, and I'm very comfortable talking about grief and death. I think it's something that we as a society should do a lot more of. I think we should all cry more and talk more about what we want when we die and how we want people to feel. And it has been really amazing to spend time with people talking about the people they've lost and the way they honor them, the funny moving things they do for anniversaries. It's felt very, very special and very profound.
People used to die at home, and now, you know, mostly people die in hospitals or institutions. It's a very different kind of a thing. I remember the Metropolitan Museum of Art had a really interesting, they do fashion exhibits. Diana Vreeland curated it for a long time, and more recently it's I can't think of her name. But it'll come to me. Anyway, they had a Victorian morning display of fashion, you know, with hair braided from a loved one into jewelry and, you know, stages of mourning. And, you know, it seems kind of ridiculous, but in a way, the rituals that they established for mourning really walked people through a period of time. It was like a year. And if you followed all that, you know, at the end of it, you pretty much processed what was going on.
I think it was amazing. So you would go through, you'd wear full black gowns, mm-hmm. and then you would progress to lavender and then to light gray. And we'd gradually get lighter and lighter. And each sort of relative had a prescribed mourning period. Mm-hmm. So for my son, because he was so young, I would have only had 6 weeks. That would have been my mourning period. If he'd have been a bit older, I'd have had a year. The thing I find really fascinating, and I might get the length of time slightly wrong, but the a Victorian woman who lost her husband would be in mourning for about 6 years, graduating through black to lavender to grey. Do you know how long a man would mourn for his wife?
Very short.
6 months.
Right.
Right, let's get on with it. Let's get on to the next one.
Right. But, you know, the other thing was that those were external symbols. So, you know, if you met a woman who was dressed in one of those colors and all, you would know that there had been, you know, it was an outward manifestation of an inward pain.
And
so
you know
speak.
What I saw on Etsy recently is little badges that say, please be kind, I'm grieving. And
really?
I think they are lovely. And I, so I haven't got one yet, but I might. Because there is, you know, sometimes there are days where it's harder than others. And wouldn't it be nice to be able to just put that badge on just to give you that little bit of protection? Even when people know that you're grieving, people still say stupid things. Mm. And I wonder, you know, maybe they did in Victorian times too. Maybe someone went up to the widow in her full gowns and said, he's in a better place now.
Right.
I mean, people say ridiculous things.
That's because people don't know what to say. You know, I don't
think that's because they haven't read my book.
That's true. I can't argue with that. But I think most of us are floored, you know, by that. And we don't really know what to say. Years ago, when I was reading the law in Virginia, because I didn't go to law school, I read the law, which is an old-fashioned thing you can't do anymore. And the judge that was my mentor and responsible for conducting me through those years developed cancer. And I went to see him in the hospital when he was coming towards the end. And he said to me, thank you for coming. He said, people I've known all my life cross the street in order not to talk to me. And I said, it's because they don't know what to say, you know.
Yeah.
But I was able to do that.
And that's wonderful. It doesn't surprise me that you were able to do that. I think if we talked about death more, then maybe people would be able to say things. I mean, it shouldn't be difficult to say, I'm so sorry this is happening to you.
Which is really all you need.
I mean,
to
that's
say.
It, isn't it? Yeah. I'm so sorry. This is terrible. This is a terrible thing that's happened to you. I'm so sorry. Even saying, I don't know what to say is better. But the idea of saying nothing at all or coming out with these trite sort of, I mean, the worst thing that people used to say to me, and lots of people said this, because I'd had twins and one of my twins had died, so many people said, at least you've got another one. As though they're sort of interchangeable, you know, that I keep one in my pocket as a spare.
Mm. Wow. So do you think, turning back to the crime writing and all, do you think having had that experience and being familiar with that emotions has made you better able to write characters and give them emotional heft that you might not have been able to do?
I do. I also think that I wouldn't be a writer if my son hadn't died. Which is a pretty incredible legacy for a 5-week-old to leave me. I think I would have stayed in the police because I left the police because life was suddenly too short. You know, I needed to do all the things. I needed to get my priorities right. I needed to be with my family, not in uniform. You know, for lots of reasons, his death was the catalyst to me leaving the police. My leaving the police meant I had to earn money. The only thing I knew how to do was to write. And so although I didn't think, well, I'll write a book and that'll become a bestseller, I wrote for newspapers and magazines, and I wrote the novel on the side. But writing became, you know, my career. But also because of the emotion that I had discovered sort of poured out of me. And not just grief. I mean, I have written a lot about grief, and my debut, I Let You Go, it isn't about my loss at all, but, you know, there's the loss of a child in there. And so inevitably, I've put a lot of my own thoughts in it. And so much about my writing now, I think, is down to that experience.
You know, it would be a terrible waste of something like that if something didn't come from it. And the fact that it moved you into writing books and sharing your thoughts and your experiences, you know, is a wonderful legacy, as you say, particularly for such a short life. Right. So, turning to other topics, this is your which book? I'm trying to remember.
Very good question. I want to say seven. Seven feels about right. I Let You Go, I See You, Let Me Lie, After the End,
right.
Hostage, The Last Party, A Game of Lies, number seven.
Okay, so Hostage was your airplane book.
Yeah.
Right, and that one, I remember, that was when you made a transition in publishing, and we talked about that. So what interested you about writing what we call an airplane thriller, but, you know, it's almost like the, you know, well, now with Boeing constantly, you know, dropping things off planes out of the sky, maybe it's more to our attention at the moment. But what interested you in writing Hostage?
I love a locked room thriller. I really, really love locked room thrillers. I liked the challenge of having a closed cast, because when you've got a closed cast, you've got to solve it within what you've given. You can't bring someone on suddenly because you're 7,000 feet in the air or however high. You can't have Mr. Poirot walking on with, you know, twirling his moustache and solving a mystery. You've got to solve it with the people already on the plane or wherever you are. So that was a challenge that I wanted to explore. And it just seemed like a cool concept. I was on a flight. So when I got the idea for Hostage, I was on a flight to San Francisco, and it's quite a long flight from the UK to San Francisco, and I had three children under 12, which makes it a really long flight, about twice as long, in fact. And I remember sitting there on the plane watching the flight attendants behind the curtain. You know, when everything goes quiet, they've served all the food and they're basically putting you to bed. You know, they turn the lights down, don't
right.
they? And they're basically saying, right, you lot, it's bedtime. And so you're sort of sitting there in the half light, and they disappear into the galley, and they're kind of off duty. And they're not really, because they're still working, but they sit down, or they kick off their heels, or they start looking through a magazine, or they're talking about their boyfriends, whatever. And it's like behind the curtains of a play, or I don't know. It's
that's
this sort
true.
Of switch.
Like the
this
cast is off yeah. stage, isn't it?
And
yeah.
so you suddenly see a glimpse into their personal life, and I loved that. I loved the fact that because it's such a long flight, they're not on duty the whole time. That they've got these sort of two sides to their
I
life.
Think they actually have mandatory rest.
They do.
Periods. They have, there's some seats on the plane, recliner seats and all, and they're all assigned to, you know, take a break and relax.
Yeah, they do. And on the, so I ended up setting my locked room thriller on a London to Sydney flight, which is 24 hours, and they have sleep.
Right.
You know, I mean, how depressing to go to do your shift at work and then go to bed and then come back and you're still on the bloody plane doing another shift. Anyway, what I liked the idea of was that a flight attendant would have to choose between their job and their family. And so I wanted to do that too. I like doing horrible things to people in fiction. I'm quite
and
nice
I,
in
and
real
I think
life.
With airplane thrillers, you know, actually just dropping the plane is not really the way readers want it to go.
No.
The real question is, you know, can you land the plane with most of the people on it still
right.
alive?
I mean,
right?
we write suspense, and so right. suspending the plane should that's the least we can do, I think.
Exactly. So you've tried, you know, different kinds of things. You've written standalones, you've had different
yep.
ideas, and now this is going to be a 3-book anyway.
Yep.
Series. What for you, what's the difference between writing a series and writing a standalone? Are there rewards and pitfalls to both?
Okay, so years ago, I remember feeling really envious of people who wrote series because I thought it must be really easy. I think at the time, I was wrestling with having to create a whole new world, a whole new cast of characters. And I remember thinking about Lee Child's books and thinking, you know, it's just Reacher. It's all the time. That's it. You know, he already knows who Reacher is. How brilliant. You know, that must be really easy. Or looking at some of my author colleagues who have a very defined world that they come back to, and it's, you know, another mystery each time. I thought, God, they've got it really easy. And then I started writing Fionn. It's so hard. It is so much harder to write a series because you're not working with the same cast all the time. You've got one or two or maybe, a handful of characters who are returning, but everyone else is brand new. And the big world that you're dealing with is kind of the same in that I'm always going to be on the border between England and Wales. But actually, the first book is around the lake, the second one's around mountains, the third one's around luxury houses. They're all new worlds. So what you end up with is all the challenges of a new story, of a standalone, with the constraints of a series where you've got things like a dog that you introduced, you know, because it would be fun.
I knew that Dave was going to come back into
this
discussion.
Bloody dog.
Someone
needs to walk the dog.
Right.
I mean, that, I'm not kidding. The dog has not been walked for the whole of book three. Nobody has walked the dog.
Right. And you're right, because, you know, Laurie King, I remember years and years ago when she wrote The Beekeeper's Apprentice and we were talking about it, and she said, writing the first book in a series, you have to be careful what you put inside the trunk, you know, like you're going on a journey, because once you put it in, you can't really take it out. So, you know, whatever their sexual orientation is, whatever their age is, whoever their family is, what their hair color is, how tall are they, how old are they, you're stuck with it.
Yes, I remember Ellie Griffiths talking about this.
With Ruth.
With
right.
Ruth, because in the very first book, or a very early book, she made a throwaway remark about how Ruth hated wearing jeans, never
right.
wore jeans. And she said, you'd never dream how many times I've wanted to stick her in a pair of jeans, and I can't
that's
because
right.
that's her thing. Yeah, it is hard. Geography has been an issue for me. So I deliberately set my world in a very sort of remote part of Wales, which is where I live, and so everywhere takes a long
right.
time to get to. That means that in subsequent books I'm constantly thinking, well, I want them to just pop back to the station, but they can't because I've been very explicit in the fact that it's 45 minutes to get to the nearest shop, you know. So that has been an issue as well.
Sure. And the problem with the series is that people want it always to be the same, but always to be different at the same time when it's a standalone. So it's very hard to take a series. You could send Fionn, for example, to a police conference in London or something and have her investigate something there. But then, you know, all the points about Wales and so forth go away.
It would. And to be honest, if I'm going to send her anywhere, I'm sending her to Scottsdale so that I get another another business trip back here.
I love it. Fionn in the botanical garden stumbles over a body that's been whacked with a saguaro.
I mean, she's definitely prickly enough
that's
to get
right.
on well in the botanicals.
Right. So how about questions from you all? PK, is there a question from you or the audience?
No, personally for me.
Okay. Can you repeat that for the virtual audience?
So
they
how?
Can hear him.
Right by the cameras, they make.
Oh,
okay. Okay. How do I set up a twist so that it doesn't cheat the reader? Mostly, my twists come right at the beginning, and so and then it becomes a game. I'll give you a little. So this isn't. It's not gonna spoil anything. But in relation to I Let You Go, there is a twist which means that you think a person is one person for... Has anyone read I Let You Go here? Mm-hmm. Okay, right. I'm not going to spoil it for the others. So there's a twist that relies on the fact that you think one person is doing one thing for a period of the book, and then you discover that they're doing another. And in order to pull that off, I created a Venn diagram, which is the least creative tool for any author. But I have this Venn diagram, you know, the big circles that cross over. So one circle was full of all the attributes and characteristics that a character in that particular set of circumstances would be feeling, thinking, doing. And the other circle was the other story. This is very difficult to explain without spoilers. And where they crossed over were the commonalities that I could use without cheating anyone. So as long as I kept to those commonalities, they were true for the story I was presenting and also the story that unfurled. It's a very forensic, right. So I think that creating twists is a very forensic process for me anyway, and I always make sure that it feels satisfying but it doesn't feel forced.
I like that approach. I think that is interesting. Some authors say that they, you know, don't write with any destination in mind and it develops out of the story. I've always found that kind of hard to imagine, but you know, so sometimes their twists just kind of seem to spontaneously occur.
I think if I were to write like that, and I don't, I plan everything, I would end up needing to go back and to seed lots of things throughout, because I don't really see how you can create a twist that doesn't come out of nowhere if you haven't sort of laid the breadcrumb trail. I'm not sure. But for me, I plan everything out. And so I'm doing this at the moment, actually. I was doing it today in the Botanical Gardens, sitting there with my notebook, starting to write a scene-by-scene breakdown of my next book, which will be 2026, another sort of big twist book. And the way that I do it is I create a table that has what happens in each scene and whose perspective I'm telling the story from. But then also something I call the reader's journey. So I have a column specifically for what I want you guys to be thinking and feeling at this particular moment in the book. So that is my chance to play God. That's me manipulating you and your reading experience before I've even written the book, in the same way that our reality TV show producers are manipulating us. So I will say, you know, in chapter 3, you, the reader, suspect this person. You like this person. You don't trust that person. And a few chapters down, you're now realizing that that person is actually trustworthy and that that's the person you need to distrust. So I will map all of that out before I start writing. You can ask whatever you want. Whether I'll answer it or not is another thing.
You mentioned WPC, so yeah. That means uniform, right? But I thought you were detective. And I read somewhere you're planning to go back.
It's come back again.
Oh, fine. Don't. Okay. Two questions there. So I was a uniformed police officer for a time. I was a detective for a time. I latterly specialised as a public order commander, so like a riot commander, which is really good practice for having kids, it turns out. So I did lots of different jobs. You did read on either Instagram or Facebook that I was going to go back to the police. That was a post that I made on April the 1st. And it has caused, honestly, my mother rang me and said, "What's all this about you going back to the police? Why haven't you told me?" I had Barbara emailing to congratulate me on going back to the police. I had a police recruitment officer ask me which force I was going to. Oh, it has caused no end of problems. I have learned my lesson. No more April Fools.
It needs to be more obviously an April Fool. I know. I thought we could talk about it. I said to her, this will be great. We can celebrate your return to the police.
I haven't got time to go back to the police.
It was nevertheless well-intentioned, if you know, better how it worked out. Indeed.
Did you have another question? Mm-hmm. Cymru. Cymru.
Cymru. Okay, mm-hmm. Something I wanted to always know. Okay.
Right. Anyone else?
Question. The Welsh, I'm from the Black Hills, South Dakota originally, and they imported the Welsh miners to do hard rock mining for the granite to get the Black Hills gold out. And then I noticed there's different settlements around the north that's primarily Welsh back. Is that as prevalent in Welsh now as in the Wales area? And has that tradition continued in any regards?
No. So the mines were closed down a really long time ago, which caused no end of unemployment. And so there are still parts of Wales that would refer to themselves as sort of mining communities, but they're not actively mining. They're communities that have, you know, abandoned mines, still have that very strong sense of identity.
Lots of the Welsh came to West Virginia, you know, for the same reason, just like the Scots went to North Carolina because it looked like the Highlands. You know, the Finns came to Minnesota because it was cold, and the Germans came to Wisconsin because it was that kind of farming that they knew back in Bavaria and so forth. So people who immigrated tended to look for places that were like home. In fact, did you watch Poldark? You know, Poldark, I think, is a, you know, but that's Cornwall, if I remember. It's not actually Wales, but yeah, kind of the same thing, right?
Don't let the Welsh hear you say that.
No, I meant the mining. I'm sorry. I just meant the mining was an important industry in Cornwall in the same way that extraction was a big part of the Industrial Revolution, which really took hold in Britain probably more strongly than anywhere in the end of the 18th century, and mining was essential to that, you know, for just like today, we're all worried that there's not enough electricity. I don't know if you've been reading about that. Rob and I, my husband and I, put in a generator 2 years ago after we were reading about the California fires, you know, where electricity was wiped out. And I think about, you know, what it would be like at 120 here if the air conditioning went out for a period of time. So I think we're all thinking about, you know, energy sources and how we can keep them going. And who would have thought that electricity might become played out in the same way that mining might? So there's a big investment, you know, in solar and wind. And I remember the last time I sailed up the river to Liverpool, I was absolutely amazed at the fact that the whole river is now full of wind
turbines.
You know, up on the Navajo Reservation, if you drive north, you know, you can. I just flew to Seattle and back for Left Coast Crime, and at one point I looked down, and there was all across the top of a whole range here in Arizona were all wind tunnels. So I think we're all trying to find, you know. And then we're also blowing up mines because we've recognized that, dams, because we've recognized that the damage to rivers has been so difficult. And dams were created partly for flood control, but a lot of it were just power, you know, water power. Mm. And now that's kind of phasing out. So who knows? But anyway, what is Welsh's main economy besides maybe tourism?
I feel like I'm in a geography exam.
Sorry.
I don't know. I think sheep farming is really big. So lamb export is huge. Not fleece, because fleeces are worth nothing. You know, the sheep fleece. Tourism is huge.
Right.
North and South Wales. I'm not sure. I don't know.
There's been a couple of Welsh-based crime shows. I don't know if you've ever watched BritBox is one. And I'm trying to remember. Anyway, there's at least two very good police procedurals that are set in Wales. And
have you had Keeping Faith here?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
that was
brilliant.
One. Yeah, absolutely. And then I'm trying to remember a different
and
one.
And Hidden is very good
as
well.
Yes, Hidden is another one. Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, there are some really good ones.
Right. I think that here's the thing. Drones have totally transformed the way, you know, shows are televised now, and you get astonishing landscapes because of the drones.
They can suddenly afford filmic
exactly
footage, can't they, that,
yeah,
that previously would have been done at huge expense with helicopters.
Right.
You had a question, I think. Am I going to be doing a standalone novel? Yes. So 2026's novel is a standalone thriller. I can't tell you anything about it, not because I don't know, because unusually for me, I already know the whole story, and I'm ready to write it. But we're not telling anyone anything about it yet. But
that's like being pregnant for years.
It is. Yeah, it is a bit like that. So the only thing I can tell you is that it's got a twist that is more audacious and more unexpected than I Let You Go. And I am phenomenally excited, because what I get to do in this book is write a twist that is every bit as good, if not better, than I Let You Go, but with the benefit of 10 years experience of writing. And, you know, like in any job, you get better at it over 10 years. So it will be my best book.
Wow, you heard it here. All right, so we'll have to make sure that Claire comes back to talk to us about it. So thank you all very much for your attention tonight. Thank you, virtual audience, for joining us. And if you would like to get one of Claire's books signed, she can just stay where she is because she's at camera height. And, you know, that's why we have this little table here. It works out really well. So thank you very much. Have a safe drive home, and night, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.